Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest Restless History members bonus podcast. Now, we find Tom Holland in a state of enormous excitement and agitation. Tom, why are you so excited?
Well, let me read out a tweet that I put up last week. Huge excitement as the rules for the Restless History's Love Island are drawn up. 10 couples new to the podcast will be sent to a luxury villa on Dominic Sandbrook's Pleasure Island. There they will have to pair up. 10 friends of the show will then arrive to stir things up. A lot of familiar faces in the running for the top prize. Now, I'm aware that that may sound like gibberish to lots of our listeners, but equally it may not to lots of others, because Love Island is very much ongoing at the moment.
Yeah.
It's a kind of reality show where hunks and babes get taken to, is it Tenerife? I can't remember where.
Sure, I think that's the phrase.
Ibiza, I think it is.
In more than 200 episodes, because we've done some Love Island recording, I think that's the single phrase you've used more than any other. Hunks and babes.
I love it. I love it. But essentially, this episode of Love Island, which you may or may not want to listen to, I think it's actually great. It's essentially a way for us to tell 10 remarkable lives.
I suppose so. Yes,
we won't give away.
The truth of the matter is, as I said myself on Twitter when you advertised it, I said we came to the Love Island episode. For those of you who are skeptical, we had just recorded 4 quite heavy duty American Civil War episodes, which I think are starting next week. Tom,
yeah, or next, in a Monday. Of weeks? Next Monday.
Going back to Love Island, and indeed our schedule. Monroe, in brackets Ramsay MacDonald, says, "I do hope that Ramsay MacDonald features on Love Island, despite Tom's prejudice against him."
I didn't have any prejudice against him.
You clearly do, apparently.
No, I didn't. I said, let's do an episode on him. It was my idea.
He may not have been a hunk in traditional terms, but romantically, he's a class all of his own. Well, the good news is we're going to do an episode on Labour's first Prime Minister for the Labour Party conference. And that man is, of course, Ramsay MacDonald.
So that's something to look forward to.
That is something to look forward to. So, Tom, should we get into some of the Discord chat?
It's been all about music still.
It has, yeah. So I've been getting some pushback from my people questioning whether, because I think the Beatles are in the class of their own.
Sui generis.
Yes, exactly, in terms of their cultural, political and cultural impact. But Ariana
Reid...
Well,
that's why they are the only music that we've covered as an episode, isn't it?
Yeah. Ariana Reid suggested Stormzy. Vandil Sulla suggested Kanye West, as whether these were people that would have the historical impact. I don't think either of them are remotely in the same league. And the fact that they may be very popular is neither here nor there, because lots of people are very popular. I think the point is a multi-generational sort of cultural and political impact through which the band or the act becomes a shorthand or a synonym for something larger than itself, for larger historical trends. That's clearly true of the Beatles. It's not true of...
And true of punk.
Yeah, true.
And I would say the one other thing that we didn't talk about, but we did talk about in the 90s episode, would be rave. That became a kind of shorthand for moral anxiety the way that punk had done.
It did.
Everyone worrying about ecstasy and... people going off in fields.
And I think relatively in quite a transitory way, though, don't you think?
It was, but...
Who cares about rave now?
Nobody cares about it now. But in the kind of 89 through to, 94, maybe, I would say that was always in the newspapers.
But it's very British, though, isn't it? The Beatles is genuinely international as a phenomenon.
Yeah.
As Elvis Presley was, I suppose I would say. I mean, Elvis is a really interesting one, because Elvis...
He has faded, hasn't he?
He has faded, but recently.
The Baz Luhrmann film coming out.
Yeah, but Elvis, it's interesting how much Elvis has faded, because clearly, certainly in America, I mean, Elvis was as easily as big as the Beatles, arguably bigger. But he seems to have had he looks dated now, doesn't he, in a way that the Beatles arguably don't? Maybe we're just portraying our age. I don't know. The trouble with any conversation about pop music.
This is the problem.
It's very hard to escape this prison of your own experience. You've been asked, Tom, for your thoughts by Imperator Beatus Brianus about Ovid. Do you have thoughts?
Well, I've got lots of views on Ovid. Love Ovid. But this happened ages ago.
So what is this?
This happened in 2017.
Yeah.
So this is... Ovid's exile. So Ovid was one of the greatest Roman poets. In fact, I think we should do an episode on Ovid because his story is a remarkable story. He gets embroiled in a massive scandal, part of which at least was sexual. And he gets exiled to the Black Sea. So he gets exiled to what's now Romania.
Right. But
he's also worth looking at because essentially what we think of as Greek mythology is Ovid's poetry. So our understanding of what...
The Metamorphoses.
So Ovid mediates Greek mythology for English literature. So Shakespeare and everybody, when they write about Greek mythology, they're writing about... It's Ovid's version of it that they're essentially writing about. And anyway, so he got exiled. He got put into exile by Augustus, and about 5 years ago, that exile got revoked. So obviously, I approve of that.
Right.
I completely approve of that.
And you've won a competition.
I have the Waterstones Durham Book Competition.
Is that a big competition?
Massive, Dominic. Were you not involved? you didn't see it.
I've no idea, but I think I'm above.
It was a kind of World Cup where people.
Right. You beat Joanne Harris of Chocolat.
I beat she was in the final. But do you know who else I beat en route? Friend of the show, Agatha Christie.
Did you? You beat Agatha Christie.
I beat well her in the Murder on the Orient Express.
I'm glad you beat Joanne Harris.
And I beat Winnie the Pooh.
She's criticised me on Twitter about something. I can't even remember what it was, but it was something.
In that case, you can enjoy my triumph.
I do enjoy it. I do enjoy
Rosa has correctly said it was the Wangs what won it. I think this prize was in no way a reflection of the literary quality of Rubicon. Very high, though, obviously, that is. It's entirely a reflection of how many Twitter followers you have. Reluctantly.
Or at least
I have to
right.
face up to the truth.
At least you're right.
And talking of flogging books
and
promoting books, Cleopatra. So we've had four episodes on Cleopatra.
Yeah, I enjoyed those episodes, I have to say. I mean, I know, obviously I'm biased, but...
it's a great story, isn't it?
I think it's a great story. She's a great character. And all the characters are great. Cicero, Mark Antony, Octavian, Julius Caesar, Pompey. You know, it's got a brilliant cast. And I will be gutted if my suggested film version with Tom Holland... Marvel's Tom Holland as Octavian does not see the light of day.
Could I read you a little passage from a top book on the Roman Republic?
He's going to, clearly. I can't stop you.
So, Dominic, this is from the introduction to Rubicon. Barely a generation after it had occurred, men were already shaking their heads in wonderment, astonished that such a time and such giants could have been. A half century later, and the panegyrist of the Emperor Tiberius, Valerius Paterculus, could exclaim that it seems an almost superfluous task to draw attention to an age when men of such extraordinary character lived, and then promptly write it up. And I've done that. You've written it up. It's the greatest story.
It is a great story.
It really is the greatest story.
So we had a couple of questions. TWM says, did the Ptolemies have any Habsburg jaw-esque issues because of their inbreeding? I would say they didn't. I'm not aware of them.
I'm not aware of any either.
He says, did the Roman, or she, I don't know if it's he or she, did the Romans make anything of it, or did they get away with it, the Ptolemies, because it was divinely sanctioned? Well, the Ptolemies obviously did get away with it, didn't they? Because, I mean, they did it for 300 years.
But the Romans did go on about it.
They did.
They saw
the Ptolemies'
kind of...
claim was that they were, because they were close to gods. So they were emulating the gods, wasn't it? Zeus and Hera.
Yeah.
Isis and Osiris. Isis and Osiris, exactly. So...
But obviously the Romans thought it was revolting.
Yeah. But I mean, the Romans were not above revolting things themselves, were they?
Yeah, but incest was an absolute staple of abuse in the late Republic.
You mean you're accused of, yeah.
Yeah, so it was seen as an aristocratic affectation. And it was seen as keeping things in the family.
Yeah.
So Clodius, who was the kind of the posh gangster... who made everyone's life misery in the 50s, and especially Cicero's, was accused of having an incestuous affair with his sister Clodia, who may or may not have been the lesbian of Catullus's poetry. This was a kind of staple abuse.
Did he?
We don't know.
Nero and Agrippina, of course, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So there's a lot of it about. Fable Skull, so how did Octavian get away with making himself pharaoh and basically annexing Egypt, becoming its king, when we said earlier that Romans despised monarchy? Was it because he did that, but didn't initially at least try to apply that model to Rome itself?
But he wasn't crowned pharaoh, was he? I mean, he's depicted as a pharaoh, but he's not crowned pharaoh. He doesn't officially
his private fiefdom.
Yeah, he doesn't take the
he
title.
He can do it
officially.
Because he's won it.
Yeah, I mean, he'd be a brilliant subject for a podcast because, as our listeners will know, one thing we do agree on is Octavian's extraordinary political acumen. It's hard to think of anybody, I think, in history with such an unenviable inheritance who turns it into this lasting model.
It's quite an enviable inheritance.
Is it, though?
A whole load of legions, enormous amounts of cash.
I think
in the name of Julius Caesar.
If you're a betting man, when does Caesar die? 44
sure.
BC?
Sure.
If you're a betting man, you're not going to bet on Octavian.
No, you're not, but he's a contender.
But he's the contender who, if you're a betting man, you think he'll probably be dead in 2 years.
Yeah,
isn't he?
Of course, but he's still a contender. I mean, it's not like he's been dealt a totally dud hand.
I think it'd be better to be... I think there'd be a lot of people looking at him then who would think he'd be better off having a nice little estate within a farm.
Of course. That's what his mother thinks. That's why she begs him not to go to Rome. I mean, lots of people think that. Cicero thinks that he can easily be manipulated.
Yeah.
Antony thinks that. Everybody thinks that. And he stiffs them all.
Yeah. All right.
Which is why he's a remarkable figure.
Three Bottle Man says it would have been great to know more about what Cleopatra was doing. Did she have any military prowess? Who ran her armies? A bit more about her court when the Romans weren't there. Well, if I can answer that question, Three Bottle Man. There's one of the editors at Penguin said exactly the same thing to me about my kids' book. Said, you know, when the Romans are not on stage, you know, you have kind of the seasons passed, Cleopatra, you know, because we don't, there's just a complete gap in the sources because all the sources are Roman. So when Cleopatra is not involved with Romans, the sources aren't really interested in what she's doing. And you could, of course, speculate. You can say, you know that there weren't massive rebellions, so she must have ruled with a degree of competence. But beyond that, it is a mystery, isn't it, Tom? We don't know the names of most of the people at the court. We know Charmian and Iras, I think, are the two people in Shakespeare who are mentioned in Plutarch as well. But apart from that, we don't really know.
This is the frustration, and indeed in many ways the fascination of ancient history, is that it's as though there's a series of kind of lighthouses with sweeping beams. And occasionally that beam will go over certain areas and it will be lit up and then it will vanish and it'll be thrown completely back into darkness. So I've having to slightly wrestle with this at the moment because I'm writing, as I may have mentioned, history of the heyday of the Roman Empire from the year of the four emperors, so 69 AD, up to the time of Hadrian. And all the emperors up to Domitian, you get biographies written by Suetonius.
Suetonius, brilliant.
And then you have the Historia Augusta, which is a kind of compilation of biographies written later, and you get Hadrian. But that misses out two key figures. One of them is Nerva, who is the emperor who succeeds Domitian. And then Trajan, who is remembered as the best of emperors, who conquers Dacia.
Colossal figure.
Conquers Parthia. Massive, famous for his column. But we don't really... considering how significant an emperor is, we don't have a biography of him. And the experience of writing a kind of a faintly narrative history of this period, when you get to Trajan, it's as though you've been listening to a radio and you've suddenly gone into a tunnel and it's blanked out. And then you come back out of the tunnel and you start to pick up frequency again. It's very frustrating. And the simple answer is we don't know what Cleopatra was doing when she wasn't involved with Caesar or Antony.
Yeah, that's good. So what do you do? What are you doing with Trajan then, Tom?
We know enough to have a vague sense of the kind of the highlights of his reign. We for Dacia, we have the column,
right?
I haven't actually given us the history of what actually happened in Dacia. I've given a sense of what people in Rome thought was happening.
Yeah,
because the column would have reflected the propaganda reports that were coming back from the front.
Right.
So that's how I've done that.
I was going to say with Octavian, we know Suetonius, I think, tells us what he ate, what he had cheese and figs, or he had his hair this way, and he, you know, basically tells us his daily routine. But with Trajan, do you have anything like that other than his strange hairstyle?
Well, we have his portrait busts, so we know how he wanted to look like, and he wanted to look like a soldier. So Nero or Domitian had very kind of curled hair.
Yeah.
So ornate, stylish, kind of cutting edge. Trajan is making a point of the opposite. He
the
has a kind
haircut.
Of pudding. Bowl haircut. But there's a kind of great deal. So we do have, you know, again, this kind of idea that every so often you get torchlight in unexpected areas. So we do have, for instance, the letters of Pliny the Younger the nephew of my great hero, Pliny the Elder, the encyclopedist. And Pliny the Younger gives a 6-hour speech in praise of Trajan.
Wow.
And at one point he says that the gods have blessed you with a receding hairline so that you may look more distinguished.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is...
I like the sound of that.
Yeah. And the other great thing that Pliny does is he gets sent to Bithynia, which is what's now kind of Turkey opposite Istanbul. So kind of the northern stretch by the south of the Black Sea. And he has to kind of sort out all the various cities there. And he's endlessly writing to Trajan saying, they've built an aqueduct. It doesn't work. They've built another one. That doesn't work either. And Trajan is endlessly kind of writing back and saying, well, what are they doing? This is useless. This is hopeless. And it's incredibly up close insight into the frustrations of Roman provincial administration in a way that you don't get for anywhere else at any other period. So even though we don't know the details of Trajan's life, for this particular area of the Roman Empire, we have absolute up detailed accounts. We know that aqueducts aren't being built. We know that you have people fiddling their expense accounts. You know that you have kind of NIMBYs complaining that a much loved ruin is being pulled down and replaced with a new shopping center, all this kind of detail.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I say, it's the frustration, but also the fascination.
I think on Cleopatra, there's one fragment where there may be her handwriting. People think it might be her handwriting. It's giving somebody a wine concession, a friend of Mark Antony's, I think, actually. And she's written at the bottom in Greek, Guinness Thoi, I think it is, which means let it be done or do it, go ahead, do it. And people think, oh, maybe this is Cleopatra's own handwriting. But actually, even with that, no one really knows whether it's hers or not. So, yeah. That's the appeal to a lot of people, isn't it? That they can fill in the blanks themselves. To sort of romantic novelists and historical novelists and things, they love ancient history because, I mean, they can paint in sort of primary colours all this stuff that's not there. But Tom, what do you do with Suetonius or something like that? Because you know deep down, don't you, that those are just formulas.
Not always. The formulae themselves are fascinating.
Yeah, they are.
They tell you all kinds of things about how the Romans understood.
Right, but they don't tell you the truth about somebody's character.
No, they don't. No, they don't. You can never know the truth.
Yeah.
But that's true of most people through most of history. Charlemagne or Attila.
Okay, Charlemagne, fine. But like anybody Alexander post, or, I would say most people post 1700.
Sure.
You can get a sense of, there are enough sources to get a sense of someone.
But that's, you know, that's 300 years.
That's current affairs. And
current affairs. Exactly. I mean, the way that I do it often is, I think I've described it as the cakeist approach, which is to do the old people said that.
Yeah, of course.
It was rumoured that.
Well, talking about people's characters, so this, I was pleased to see some good discussion about Agrippa versus Cicero. So one of these men, hardworking, pragmatic, serious, gets things done. The other, fat, pompous, windbag.
We're talking Cicero.
Yeah.
So this is Simon Girdleston.
Simon Girdleston has excellent opinions. He says Agrippa is very much the anti-Cicero. Cicero doesn't really do anything beyond being a windbag, prosecutes some people at the law courts, writes rude letters and people and gets murdered. Agrippa actually did things, built things. He knew Octavian was a winner and made himself indispensable and was central to establishing and maintaining the Augustan age. In brackets, Tom may disagree.
I disagree with that.
You do disagree with it?
No, I don't. I think Agrippa was, and Maecenas as well, were fundamental figures in the establishment.
Tom, this is a lie, because you dissed Agrippa in Rubicon. You said he was boring.
Yeah, well, he is boring.
He's not boring.
He's boring. He's really boring. But he's incredibly efficient. You know, he kind of goes in boats through the Cloaca Maxima, through the great drains. He's a drains and naval facilities
he
man.
He wins the war for Octavian.
I know he does, but he's dull.
He's
kind of Trajanic. I mean, he's a kind of model of practical, ruthless, faintly coarse building.
I love that. That's the kind of
I'm not disputing it, but he is compared to Cicero,
the
boring.
Between us, isn't it? This is the tension at the heart of the podcast. Because I think Cicero, you're the
practical, honest voice of Middle
Agrippa
England.
Agrippa is so Cicero is Jolyon Morm, and Agrippa is Theresa May.
Well, what a choice. What I would say about Cicero, in defense of Cicero, is that Cicero is a product of a republican system that is still functioning. And in a way, he dies as a martyr for it. Agrippa is a product of an autocratic system, and indeed facilitates it. And the, you know, it's the ancient Roman equivalent of making the trains run on time.
Right, I think that is harsh, because you're tainting Agrippa with fascism there, which I think is mean spirited.
Well, the fascists in no way, Mussolini in no way, look to Augustus as a role model.
Well, yeah, but that's, you can't, that, I don't think you can damn Augustus with that. I mean, you can't control who looks to you.
The Augustan system was an autocracy, and Agrippa and Maecenas were right-hand men in what was essentially a coup.
Wouldn't you rather have lived under the order of the Augustan age than the shambles of the late Republic?
I would, but Cicero has a much more difficult, both of them come from obscurity. That's the point. That's why it's a good comparison. But Cicero obviously has to negotiate a republican system that is still functioning and masters it. Agrippa doesn't have to bother with any of that flam because he's attached himself to a guy who is essentially a terrorist.
I think he's not a terrorist. I think, why do you call him a terrorist? You always call him a terrorist, but I think he's not a terrorist.
He kills anyone who stands in his way.
That's not a terrorist. That's not Carlos the Jackal.
He exercises terror over the course of the triumvirate.
That's not a terrorist.
It's someone who practices terror.
I mean, would you say Catherine the Great was a terrorist?
I don't know enough about Catherine the Great.
No, that's a very evasive answer. I think being a tough ruler is not the same as being a terrorist.
No, I would say call him a terrorist in a way that, say, I wouldn't call Caligula or Nero a terrorist, because Caligula and Nero have the apparatus of the state behind them. Yeah. The frameworks exist there. The future Augustus seizes control of the state by terrorist means.
It's not
paramilitary means.
It's not blowing up people in marketplaces or something.
Maybe it's chopping their heads off, nailing their hands to the rostra.
Yeah, but I mean, that's... I don't have a problem with that. Do you have a problem with that?
Can't make an omelette without breaking
exactly,
legs.
Exactly, can't break an omelette. And I think terrorism is the right word. Right, let's talk about another greatly maligned character from history. And that man is, of course, Richard Milhouse Nixon. So we re-released the Watergate episodes, didn't we, Tom?
We did that purely, didn't we? So that people celebrating the anniversary would have something to listen to.
Celebrating the anniversary of Watergate?
It was pure golden-hearted generosity of spirit.
I'm not convinced that many people were celebrating the Watergate.
Were you not?
What, with a cake or something?
Wearing the wrong shoes on the beach.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it was nice because Watergate episodes were quite a long time ago, so we decided to put them up in the feed because it was the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, and we really enjoyed doing those episodes. And they sort of never lose their sheen, do they? Because basically there's always some ludicrously gate-themed, suffixed scandal. So the interesting questions, was Nixon always doomed from Phil 32? I think probably was. I can't remember. It's a bit while since we did those episodes, but I think he was doomed once the burglars started talking and once it was obvious that certainly with the tapes, and the tapes doomed him completely. Rosa said, I'm guessing these events would not have brought down Trump if relocated to our present. That's a very interesting question.
Well,
would they bring down anybody?
I think, in a way, I suppose it depends on the expectations of the political culture.
Right. And I think so Clinton was impeached and acquitted. Trump was impeached and twice acquitted. And in both those instances, well, all three of those instances, I should say, I think the key difference was the ever-increasing partisanship of American political life, such that in both cases, Clinton and then Trump, they could count on almost all their supporters to stay loyal, which wasn't really the case with Nixon. Because, you know, Republicans voted for
They hadn't had a gate by that point.
Had a gate. So. But they were much less entrenched, I would say, in their tribalism than they are now. So there is a sort of slight sense. We're not a politics podcast. We don't want to get into kind of too much political punditry. But I think there was definitely a sense that there was you started to wonder, well, what would Donald Trump have to do for his own party to turn on him, I mean, particularly after the January the 6th, is the January 6th Capitol riot. If they didn't turn on him after that, you kind of wonder, well,
yeah,
what would he have to do? Mind you, somebody said the same thing to me about Boris Johnson the other day. A Tory journalist said to me, what does Boris have to do for, you know, his own backbenchers to get rid of him?
Well, it's quite an interesting parallel, because I think that a lot of the things that the kind of scandals that have become associated with his name, his response to them is to say, I don't care, and just carry on. And it kind of throws up if people don't play by the accepted rules, what sanctions are there within a democracy to enforce them?
Exactly. Yes, absolutely right. Because, of course, Nixon...
And he obeys the rules, basically.
He does... Yeah, he bends the rules. He breaks the rules. But he still has a residual respect for the rules, I suppose, so that he feels embarrassed and ashamed and guilty. And he knows that everybody around him, all the Republican power brokers, take the rules very seriously. The Barry Goldwaters and all these
And the American people take them seriously.
And the American people take them seriously, agreed.
London in the Wild, Nixon will probably be remembered as a mediocre president at best, even without Watergate, although perhaps not as bad as Carter because of the economy. Most of Nixon's achievements concerned foreign policy, China and Vietnam, whereas at home, this was the era of spiking inflation, wage and price controls, and the 1973 oil crisis right as Watergate was unfolding.
Well, first of all, on Jimmy Carter, of course, will be making his debut on Love Island.
Dominic, you've given it away.
Well, it's exciting for people to know. I've put it up on Twitter weeks ago. There's a picture of Jimmy Carter up there.
You can't do that.
You've seen it. You've responded to it.
I'm trying to blank it. I'm trying to pretend it hasn't been done.
So Jimmy Carter.
I hope that listeners who've heard that will forget that Jimmy Carter's on it. Dominic is not meant to be giving this away.
Yeah, because it's so important. You can't
it's
give
so
it away.
It's so important. Didn't Joe Biden have a Jimmy Carter moment this weekend where he fell off a bike?
He fell off a bike, but that's not the same.
Jimmy Carter collapsing.
Joe Biden is like three times the age that Jimmy Carter was when he was president. Nixon, mediocre president, I'm not sure about that. He absolutely right, London in the Wild, that this was an era of terrible economic turmoil. The end of the Bretton Woods Agreement, the sort of currency stability, massive inflation, wage and price controls, oil crisis, all completely agreed. However, would he be remembered for that, or would he be? He would, I think, be remembered for China and Vietnam. Were it not for Watergate,
he still is, isn't he?
Yeah, would he be remembered for as a mediocre president? I don't know. Mediocre is the word. There's nothing mediocre about Nixon. Nixon's terribly divisive. He'd never be in the top 10 American presidents because he's too divisive, I think. Yeah. Would he be remembered? I don't know. I mean, it's interesting how Reagan is so fondly remembered by Americans themselves, but you could argue that in some ways, actually, Reagan's quite a mediocre president and his achievements are really foreign policy. But at home, what does he actually achieve? He leaves America with a massive deficit and his economic miracle is slightly built on sand. Anyway, this is a subject for another day because Reagan is actually a brilliant subject for a podcast, Tom.
Well, hey...
Reagan.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of time to work on, because I don't think we'll be able to fit Reagan in between now and the end of the year.
Well,
so you've got a long time to work on Reagan. I'd like to see a Nancy Reagan impersonation as well.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, there could be Margaret Thatcher's in there, Gorbachev, you know,
Al Haig,
a lot of friends of the show, Mitterrand, Chirac, they're all around in those, those years. So it could be a real 80s kind of. Could be like an episode of Spitting Image.
Yeah, or Top Gun.
Like Top Gun. Yeah. Well, Top Gun is very Reagan era, isn't it? You a big fan of Top Gun, Tom?
I haven't seen it because I've had COVID.
Have you seen the original?
Years ago. I wasn't a fan.
Were you not?
No, I don't like planes. I'm bored of planes. I hate planes. It's like you in science.
Oh, right. Okay.
Planes. I couldn't be less interested.
I used to listen to the Top Gun anthem. Before exams, before my A-levels.
Did you? Did it work?
I think it did work. To get me in the mood, you know, sort of all-conquering, sort of, in my mind, I was the sort of the maverick of A-level history. Leather jacket, you know, very popular with the ladies, very short.
I was the other one.
What were you, Goose? Iceman?
No, Iceman.
You were Val Kilmer.
Yeah, it's Val Kilmer.
He's unrecognizable now.
Is he?
I don't think he's got very fat. No plastic surgery, I think. I mean, I hope he's not listening and doesn't sue me. that's not a road I would advise you to go down, to be honest.
I'm not going to.
No, I can't promise. If you did, I wouldn't be one of these people who says nothing about it and pretends.
Well, I don't need to because I look only youthful, so it's fine.
Yeah, the elite sporting silhouette.
So in that sense, I'm very like Tom Cruise.
Slightly sinister.
No, in my approach to exams, I don't need kind of pumping anthems or leather jackets. I just go in coolly, clinically, right. Exercise my skills.
Sacral. Right.
In a sacral manner, exactly.
Okay.
Okay, everyone, listen, we're spiraling off here. I don't think there's any much doubt who the Top Gun is, though.
What are we doing next week?
No, we will see.
What are we doing next week? We're doing the American Civil War. So you've got... I'm unclear how we're going to release those, but basically
Monday, Tuesday,
yeah, Thursday, but for the Westerns History Club members, Friday. Tom.
Oh yes, of course.
They'll get a few of them early. I'm not sure how we'll structure that. But listen, you'll start to get this drip of all at once. Says Don.
All at once.
Oh my God, loads of episodes.
All at once. So you'll have them all in one go, and then you'll have nothing until Love Island.
Well, God, don't binge on them. That is my one. Don't listen to them all at once. Not least because, I mean, then you'd be listening for like 5 or 6 hours, which is...
Yeah, it's very Dan Carlin-esque, isn't it? We've turned into Dan Carlin.
Yeah, we have. But actually...
And there are worse things to turn into.
The thing is with that American Civil War... Oh, Dom says all the Wangs will be at Glastonbury anyway. So is that happening? Are you going to Glastonbury,
Or at
Tom?
The Chalk Valley History Festival.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which is happening this week.
Is that this week?
It is this week, yes.
Do you want to...
I've got to go
that?
Tomorrow. Well, having said that, I've got to go yesterday because we're recording this on Monday. You'll be listening to this on Wednesday. I've got to be there on Tuesday.
All right.
Well, so, yes, I'll be there all week. So if you're going to that, give me a big shout. I know that one or two people have already mentioned it on Twitter that they'll be there and on the Discord. So one of the Wangs asked me what the way of, you know, is there a Wang greeting? And so I've said, obviously, waggle your ears. So,
right.
Looking forward to that.
We need to work on a handshake, don't we? Okay. Yeah, we do. On that note, we'll see you all next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.